Welcome. Thank you very much. Bob, thank you for those very kind and undeserved words. You know, you took quite a chance there with all that you were saying about me. In the next 30 minutes, I can make a bum out of you. You know, I'm all a little hard put to get underway tonight, and really, it's happened just in the walk from the door of the bridge out there on the way in, as I've met so many of you who've made references in the fairly recent past to having heard me speak. I think that probably the only words that are left for me to open with are to say, well, as I was saying. Well, I could continue and say, let me repeat. You know, the fact, however, that you have heard me and that I'm still singing the same single-note song doesn't mean that you're going to get out of here in the next 10 minutes, because I once learned the hard way that whether you have anything to say or not, you should keep on talking. I used to be a sports announcer back in the Midwest, and we used to broadcast Big Ten football games and the Cubs and Sox baseball games out of Chicago. And one day, a very noted evangelist from California came to our town to hold a series of revival meetings. And an enterprising public relations man thought it would be a good idea if we were interviewed on our radio station. Now, why they picked a sports announcer to interview the late Amy Semple McPherson, I'll never know. But I drew the job, I asked her some questions, she answered them graciously, and then went into a fervent plea concerning the success of her meetings, and I sat down. Until I was horrified to hear her saying goodnight to our radio audience, and there were 4 minutes to go by the studio clock. I didn't know enough about Amy Semple McPherson, that is, that I could put on the air to fill 4 minutes. So I did like this, which means get a record ready. And a big sleepy kid in the control room reached back, pulled one off a stack, put it on the turntable, and nodded, go ahead. And in my most dulcet tones, I said, ladies and gentlemen, we conclude this broadcast by the noted evangelist Amy Semple McPherson with a brief interlude of transcribed music. I expected nothing less than the Ave Maria. The Mills brothers started singing Minnie the Moocher's Wedding Day. So, pretend you haven't heard anything before and we'll try again. You know, the same James Madison who warned us that freedom, more freedom, had been lost by silent and gradual encroachment than by violent and sudden usurpation, looked far into the future and said, we rest all our experiments, our political experiments, on the capacity of mankind for self-government. Not too long ago, two friends of mine were talking to a Cuban refugee, a businessman who had escaped from Havana. And in the midst of his tale of horrible experiences, one of my friends turned to the other and he said, we don't realize how lucky we are. And the Cuban stopped and said, how lucky you are. I had some place to escape to. And it's as simple as that. There's the whole story. If it's lost here, where do we find it again? We're in a world that is divided. On one hand, the most evil enemy that mankind has ever known, even if he is nurtured on American wheat. Sometimes I think Washington wouldn't be as mad at De Gaulle if he loaded the buses with wheat before he sold them. We're in a nation. Our nation is divided. On one hand, we have those who believe in individual freedom, and on the other, those people who subscribe to a belief that our traditional system is incapable of solving the complex problems of the 20th century. Well, the issue of this election is whether we believe in man's capacity for self-government, or whether we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves. Senator Goldwater recently uttered what is probably one of the most profound statements of the campaign so far when he said in 1964, it's not just another election. This is one of those rare moments of historic decision. Well, we cannot successfully meet the challenge of this election and its importance to the problems of a divided world and nation with a splintered party. We have come to a time for choosing. Do we want to win a convention, or do we want to win an election? The Achilles heel of our opponents is that they are today ideological freeloaders. They pay lip service to the ancient truths, the campaign oratory of constitutional freedom, the individual rights, free enterprise, but in practice, they adopt the political expedient that leads toward collectivism and, yes, socialism. We don't have to use our own words of accusation. Senator Clark, one of the most articulate spokesmen for the liberal cause, defines liberalism as, quote, meeting the material needs of the masses through the full power of centralized government. Well, I don't know about you, but in the first place, I'm disturbed when a representative of our people refers to you and me as the masses. There's a foreign sound to this. But beyond that, the full power of the central government is the very thing the Founding Fathers sought to minimize. Wherever we turn today, man's right to choose is being questioned. Howard K. Smith, a name not unfamiliar to many of us, has put it that the distribution of goods must be affected by a planned economy. The profit motive is outmoded and must be replaced by the incentives of the welfare state. And so urged on by humanitarian motives, there are an increasing number of people in America today who can't see a fat man standing beside a thin one without automatically coming to the conclusion the fat man got that way by taking advantage of the thin one. So they seek the answer to all the problems of human need through government. And the result is that we have seen in our adult lifetime the government lay its hand on health, on housing, on farming, on industry, commerce, and education, and it has interfered with the people's right to know. At the same time, government has proven conclusively that outside its legitimate function, the protection of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, government does nothing as well or as economically or as efficiently as the private sector of the economy. Not too long ago, some campaign speaking resulted in a hue and cry being raised over the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA. It's a funny thing, even among many of us who question some of the actions of government. There are some things that if they're just around long enough in government, they seem to become as sacred as motherhood. Now, I doubt that TVA will become a campaign issue. But because it is such a sacred cow, because it's supposed to be such an example of the omnipotence of government, surely we can look even if we mustn't touch. So let's do a little checking on this thing that caused such a disturbance among so many people. TVA, some 35 years ago, started as a flood control project. The Army engineers said that once in 500 years, it was possible to have a complete total flood in the Tennessee Valley that would inundate some 660,000 acres. So they fixed that. They flooded 1 million acres permanently and made it a lake. And the annual interest on the TVA debt is 5 times greater than the annual flood damage they sought to correct. Ah, but they say, look at the electric power that's generated by the waters impounded behind the dam. That's right. They did do that and supplied electricity in some of the rural and remote areas. But today, 85% of all the electricity produced by TVA is produced in steam generating plants, not by those impounded waters. Ah, but they say we're ignoring the waterway, the commercial travel on that waterway that was created. That's right. And the overwhelming bulk of all of the commerce on that waterway is coal being barged to the TVA steam generating plant. And the annual cost of simply keeping the channel navigable would pay for shipping every ounce of that coal by rail, and they'd have money left over. And then to top it off, some people say, yes, but government has to do a certain amount of spending and participate in the economy in order to bring about prosperity. And so today we find that the Labor Department officially lists more than half the 169 counties in the Tennessee Valley as permanent areas of poverty, distress, and unemployment. As I say, this undoubtedly will not be a campaign issue, nor should it be. But Passamaquoddy could. Now, there's a name to conjure with. I grew up hearing the name Passamaquoddy. This is a bay, an area in Maine, where the tides come in 18 feet high. And through a system of some 350 dams and locks, about 30 years ago, it was suggested they could harness the tide and generate electricity. Well, everyone that has investigated this and researched it from an engineering standpoint has said the project is impractical, extravagant, and probably wouldn't work. But this year, there is a senator to be elected in Maine. And so the government announces that Passamaquoddy is going to be revived. It'll take 15 years to build it. It will cost over $1 billion. In the meantime, Consolidated Edison Company of New York is building an atomic power plant that will take one-fifth the money, one-half the time, and produce the same amount of electricity, and they know it'll work. No part of our economy has felt the heavy hand of government force and coercion like the agricultural section of our economy. One-fourth of farming in America has seen a steady decline over recent decades in the per capita consumption of everything it produces. That one-fourth of farming is responsible for 85% of all of the agricultural surplus in America. That one-fourth of farming, for some 30-odd years, has been regulated and subsidized by government. By contrast, the three-fourths of farming that is out on the free, open market has seen an average 21% increase in per capita consumption of everything it raises. If you were surprised when the wheat farmers voted against Santa Claus last spring, you might be interested in the story of one Western wheat farmer. 10 years ago, he wasn't getting any help from the government. His wheat was selling for $2.05 a bushel, and he paid 20 cents a loaf for bread. Now, for 10 years, he's had government help. He gets $1.89 for his wheat, and bread costs 36 cents a loaf in his neighborhood. 3 years ago, there was no specific feed grain program to encourage farmers to grow less feed grain. Now, we've had 3 years and $2.5 billion, and the 1963 corn crop was 100 million bushels greater than the 1960 crop before we started to control it. In these last 3 years, we have seen a reduction of 450,000 farms in the country, and there are 2 million fewer people on the farms than there were when we started to help them. One congressman has figured that the cost is $43 for every dollar bushel of grain we're not raising. The farmers plead for a return to the free market economy, but they whistle in the wind. Now there is one Department of Agriculture employee for every 31 farms in the country. And they still can't figure out how 66 shiploads of grain headed for Austria could disappear without a trace. Meanwhile, back in the city under urban renewal, we have seen private property rights diluted so that public interest is anything that a few government planners determine it should be. Perhaps some of you have heard me tell of one key eastern city where one man owning a large section in the heart of the city sold that section to urban renewal for several million dollars, then submitted to the government his own plan for refurbishing it, and they sold him back his own property for 22% of the purchase price. Already, this administration has announced that next year there will be a step up in federally subsidized housing. The words that were used were, we will be building units in the thousands where we have been building them in the hundreds. But FHA and the Veterans Administration right today are sitting on 120,000 dwellings they have obtained through foreclosure of mortgages, mostly because of little or now down payments and easy terms that resulted in the homeowner in discovering that the unpaid balance on his home amounted to more than the house was worth. Some of these homes, they've announced, will be bulldozed down so they can start over. But for the most part, they're going to be refurbished, painted up, and resold. Many of them for as little as $100 down and 35 years to pay. That'll give them another crack at foreclosing them in a few years, and then the bulldozer will get its second chance. It's in the area of social welfare, though, that the government has found its most fertile growing bed. Because so many of us accept our responsibility for those less fortunate, we're all susceptible to humanitarian appeals. Today, federal welfare spending is 10 times greater than it was in the dark depths of the Depression. In my own county, Los Angeles County, and I'm afraid it's probably pretty typical of all the rest of them, the Department of Charity expends 44% of all the money that is spent in that county. The welfare bill in Los Angeles County is greater than the total amount of real estate tax collected in the county. Adding all of those on welfare to those on salary and receiving subsidies, there are today 48 million Americans receiving some form of direct cash payment from government. And 38 million of those are receiving it from the federal government. And what are we doing to the people we have sought to help? Recently, a judge called me. He told me he thought I might be interested in the story. He said a woman had come to him for a divorce. Fairly young woman, 7 children, pregnant with her 8th. She wants a divorce, and under his questioning, it finally developed. Her husband is a laborer earning $250 a month. By divorcing him, she can get an $80 a month raise. She's eligible for $330 a month on the Aid to Dependent Children program. The judge said, if you think this is an isolated case, she confessed to me that she was talked into doing this by 2 women in her own neighborhood who had already done the same thing. And yet, when we question any of the grandiose government schemes of the do-gooders, we're denounced as being opposed to their humanitarian goals. We are the people who would throw the elderly into the street to die. We are the people who want no one who can't afford a doctor to have medical care. They charge that we're always against things. We're never for anything. Well, you know, the trouble with too many liberals is not that they're ignorant. It's that they know so much that isn't so. We're for some things. We're for providing so that destitution will not follow unemployment by reason of old age. We're against the irresponsibility of those in charge of Social Security, who have told us in 100 million pieces of literature since 1939 that this is an insurance program adequately funded. And then they admit to Congress that Social Security today is $298 billion in the red. They promised that the tax would never exceed 6% of $3,000 of income, and today it's 7.5% of $4,800 of income, and 2 more raises are scheduled between now and 68 to bring it to 9.25%. They promised that the least that any citizen could get back from this program was the fundamental inherent in any insurance program, that he would get back at least what he had put in. And today we find the young man in his 20s is contributing, he and his employer, $1.69 for every dollar the government promises him in return. A young man today will find that his contribution, if he's earning an average salary, will buy him in the open market a retirement insurance policy that will guarantee $220 a month at age 65, and the government promises him $127. We shouldn't have been surprised that this would happen to this government program. Just recently, it was revealed that the Civil Service Retirement Fund, administered by our government, is facing bankruptcy and is $37 billion in the hole. By contrast, we look to the private pension funds in our many industries and unions, and we discover that some 30 million of our workforce are protected by pension funds that are financed by $70 billion, soundly invested in securities and real estate
and other investments. We are for putting Social Security on a sound actuarial basis, for introducing voluntary features. We're for telling our senior citizens that no one in this country should be denied medical care because of a lack of funds. But we're against forcing all citizens, regardless of need, into a compulsory government insurance program. Even here, the contrast between government and free enterprise is glaring and overwhelming. The proposed or promised Medicare program will provide partial hospital expense only. And a young man will find that he is paying under this proposal $44 a year, so that if he reaches age 65, he will be eligible for that partial help on any hospital expense he might incur. Today, there are 141 million Americans, 76% of our population, covered by some kind of medical or hospital insurance. This does not count the people presently being cared for under the Kerr-Mills bill. We're against government for government's sake. Recently in the state of New Jersey, insurance companies asked the state for permission to pool their resources and their risks to bring out a health insurance policy for senior citizens that would put it within the reach of all but those completely destitute. They were denied permission to do this. And in denying them the permission, the governor of New Jersey said, if we let them do that, it would make it harder for the federal government to get its compulsory program passed. Could any of us honestly be charged with opposing the noble purpose of the Peace Corps? Since the inception of our nation, in almost every religious order, we have supported voluntarily missions, sending volunteers to every corner of the earth to do precisely what the Peace Corps has been established to do. We are against possible bureaucratic overhead and waste. There is one religious order in this country today that can send a volunteer and keep him overseas for $900 a year. The Peace Corps prorates out to $9,000 a year for each volunteer. Now they tell us they want to help the young people at home. They want to revive something like the old CCC camp of the Depression days. And if you look closely at the proposed bill, you find it'll prorate out to $7,000 for every young person we're going to help. Hell, we can send them to Harvard for $3,000. Of course. Of course, don't get me wrong, I'm not recommending Harvard as an answer to juvenile delinquency. We're for defense, but we're against pretending that all government extravagance can be justified under the banner of defense spending. Since the Korean War, the cost of running our government has gone up $20 billion a year, and $17 billion of that is for non-defense spending. We're for an international organization where the nations of the world can legitimately seek peace. We're against subordinating American interests to an organization so structurally unsound that a two-thirds majority in the General Assembly can be mustered among nations that represent only 10% of the world's population and only contribute 5% to the assessed budget of the UN. We are against the hypocrisy of assailing our allies for supposed vestiges of colonialism while we join in a conspiracy of silence about the peoples enslaved behind the Iron Curtain. Yes, we are for aiding our allies by sharing our material blessings with those nations which share in our fundamental beliefs. We are against doling out money government to government, financing socialism all over the world. We set out to help 19 war-ravaged allies. We're now helping 107 nations. We've spent $146 billion. We bought 1,000 TV sets with 23-inch screens yet for a country that has no electricity. We bought dress suits for undertakers in Greece. We used foreign aid funds to buy extra wives for government officials in Kenya. We bought Haile Selassie a $2 million yacht and called it foreign aid. When Congress moved to cut the foreign aid appropriation this year, they were told by the administration that a cut of even $1 would immediately endanger our national security. And then when the fight was over, we discovered they still had $700 million left from last year they hadn't spent. Perhaps some of you have heard me tell the story related by Dr. Howard Kirshner, who was speaking to the Prime Minister of Lebanon. And the Prime Minister of that little country said, "Dr. Kirshner, my country balances its budget every year. We have no deficit. We have no inflation. We have a modest tax rate." And he said, "We have increased our gold holdings from $70 million to $120 million. And when he finished, Dr. Kirshner said, "Mr. Prime Minister, my country hasn't balanced its budget 28 out of the last 34 years. My country has a debt greater than the combined debt of all the nations of the world. My country is losing gold so fast that the solvency of our currency is endangered. We have inflation. We have a near confiscatory tax rate, higher than has ever been borne by any nation in civilized history. Do you think under these circumstances we should continue to give your country millions of dollars each year?" And the Prime Minister smiled and said, "No, but if you're stupid enough to do it, we're going to take the money." And so in Lebanon, we have just finished building a stock farm for them. We built 9 stalls for each bull. We have $15.5 billion worth of gold in our vault, and we don't own an ounce. Dollar foreign claims against that gold tonight total $27.3 billion. We're living on the sufferance of our friends who don't dare put us out of business because they're hiding behind our armed strength. In the last few years, 52 nations have purchased $7 billion worth of our gold. All 52 nations are receiving foreign aid. Because no government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size, government programs once launched never disappear. Bureaucracy grows and at the same time assumes a permanency bordering on immortality. Actually, a federal bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth. A manual of the United States government lists by name every congressman and every senator and every agency and bureau that comes under the Congress of the United States, and it takes 25 pages. And then they list the agencies and bureaus that come under the executive branch of government, and it takes 520 full pages. And what happens to freedom when the executive branch of government can use the money taken from the people in order to coerce the people? Tyranny is inevitable when the elected representatives, reflecting the will of the people, are robbed of policy-making functions by bureaus and agencies, by appointees of government who cannot be reached or touched by the ballot. When Congress was debating whether to lend $100 million to the United Nations, the State Department, without asking anyone's permission, handed the United Nations $217 million, and they used part of that money to pay Castro's delinquent dues in the UN. A year ago, our Congress legislated into law a denial of foreign aid to any nation selling oil to Cuba. In the first 6 months of this fiscal year, foreign aid has continued to go to the amount of $145 million to 4 nations regularly selling oil to Cuba. Under bureaucratic regulations arbitrarily adopted, with no regard to the wish of the people, we have already lost much of our constitutional protection against search and seizure. Agents can invade a man's property without a warrant, impose fines without a trial, seize property, and sell the property at auction to enforce the payment of that fine, simply if they suspect a citizen of violating a bureau's regulation. Not a law of this land. In Ohio, a deputy fire marshal recently sentenced a man to prison after a secret proceeding, and the accused was not even allowed to have a lawyer. And the United States Supreme Court upheld the sentence, ruling, quote, "It was an administrative investigation of incidents damaging to the economy." But Supreme Court Justice Goldberg told the nation's judges and lawyers recently, "Put aside your discredited theories of the Constitution and support the Warren Court." In the last 3 years, we have added more than 130,000 federal employees. 40,000 more are scheduled in the present budget. If the rate continues that we've been of growth that we've had in the last 3 years, by 1970, one-fourth of the total workforce of the nation will be employed by government. As it is, right now, every five of us that are earning a living are paying the full salary of a sixth member of the workforce who is now employed by government, federal, state, or local. No one knows what they all do. One congressman found what one of them did. He found a fellow in Washington whose job was sitting at a desk. Documents came to his desk. He read them, initialed them, passed them on to the proper agencies. Recently, one came to his desk by mistake. He read it anyway, initialed it, and sent it on. The next day, it came back, 24 hours later, with a memorandum attached. Said, "You weren't supposed to read this. Erase your initials, and initial the erasure." The national natural gas producers have found out what others of government do. Within the last few weeks, these producers of natural gas have been handed a 428-page questionnaire. The pages are more than 24 inches long and have space on them for hundreds of entries. They are to fill it out in quadruplicate. It has been estimated it will take 70,000 accountant man-hours to make out this report. I wonder how many government employees are going to be hired to read those reports. The Railroad Association announces that it costs the railroads of America, beleaguered as they are, $5 million a year just to fill out ICC forms. Freedom of speech? Do we really have it as much as we think we do? When television and radio stations must go back periodically to the Federal Communications Commission for renewal of license, and one of the conditions for renewal is content of what they've had on the air in their programs? If we should decide on a new Declaration of Independence, let's keep one clause from the old one. That sentence that reads, "He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance." Lowell Mason, former antitrust law enforcer of the Federal Trade Commission, has written a book in which he states that American business is being harassed, bled, and even blackjacked under a crazy quilt system of laws. There are so many that the government literally can find some charge to bring against any concern it chooses to prosecute. You see, it doesn't require expropriation of property or confiscation of private business to impose socialism on a people. What does it matter whether you retain the deed to your property or your business if the government determines the basis on which it can remain open? A president of the United States once said, "The doctrine of regulation and legislation by masterminds in whose judgment and will all the people may gladly and quietly acquiesce has been too glaringly apparent in Washington. Were it possible to find masterminds so unselfish, so willing to decide unhesitatingly against their own personal interests, such a government might be to the interest of the country, but there are none such on the political horizon." Is this a voice from the distant past, from, say, the extreme right wing that is warning us? No, these are the words, believe it or not, of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's a quote we will probably not hear in campaign oratory from our opponents in the coming campaigns. To those of us who have long advocated tax reform as a means of curbing government growth, there's little joy in the present proposed legislation. Certainly, tax reform is overdue. The late Sumner Slichter of Harvard said, "If a visitor from Mars looked at our tax policy, he would conclude it had been designed by a communist fifth columnist to make free enterprise unworkable." But we cannot have tax reform that will eliminate confusion and complexity and cure the discrimination inherent in the progressive surtax while such reform is engineered by people who view the tax as a means of achieving social reform. Now, this is not a baseless accusation. In the testimony that went on before the House Ways and Means Committee, and without exception, those representing the administration revealed that they view the income tax not as a means of raising revenue, but as a means of controlling the economy and redistributing the earnings and the wealth of our citizens. 1 month ago, today, 1 month ago this very day, standing in the White House, the president said to a group of senior citizens, "We are going to try to take all the money we think is being unnecessarily spent and take it from the haves and give it to the have-nots that need it so much." Of course, we realize the president has promised to economize in this election year. He's also promised Medicare, federal aid to education, more urban renewal, expansion of federal housing, rapid transit, and the billion-dollar war on poverty. Now, of course, this shouldn't be too hard for a man who ran in 1960 for the vice presidency on a platform of greater power for the central government, and at the same time he ran for the Senate on a Texas platform that demanded, quote, or denounced, growing and menacing concentration of power in the central government. The image makers in Washington are busy now creating his picture, the picture of the man in the White House, as a tall, silent man. Well, they're not entirely false with that. He's tall by physical standards of measurement, and certainly he is silent. He is silent about TFX. He's silent about Billy Sol Estes. And he's sure as hell silent about Bobby Baker. And up in Sacramento, little Sir Echo is snug in his bed with dreams of dreams of the vice presidency run through his head. He heard the economy talk, and he sent a memorandum and told everybody that worked for the state to save their pencils and sharpen them down to the nub, and then submitted the biggest budget in California history. There'd really be a combination, wouldn't it? President and vice president on the ticket, Tweedledull and Tweedledum. It has been said that if we lose this way of ours, this system of freedom, history will report with the greatest astonishment that those who had the most to lose did the least to prevent its happening. Well, obviously, you intend to do something about it, or you wouldn't be here. I wish I could give you some magic formula. Unfortunately, there is no such thing in politics. One of the first things I could tell you that we must do in this coming campaign year is rid ourselves of the idea that the opponent is invincible. This is the biggest snow job that has ever been foisted off on us, is the idea that he can't be licked. If you want to prove this to yourself, I'll ask you to do just one thing. Just stop for a minute and think if you know of anyone who voted Republican in the 1960 election who has told you they've changed their minds and are going to vote the other way in the coming election. There were 34 million of us, and that was probably an honest count. Of course, conservatism in America has always been a stronger force. We have, again, a minority administration in Washington, less than 50% of the vote. The splinter parties that took part of our vote were actually ultra-conservative parties, running on more conservative platforms than the Republicans, but total, added together, it forms more than 50%. Now, in the months ahead, we will be divided by our own primary. Feelings will run high. Our emotions will be aroused. Some among us will urge that we, in an effort to get victory, that perhaps we should adopt the philosophy of our opponents, that we should join them and offer more government by Big Brother, with only a choice between personalities. Well, the answer to that, of course, is, then why bother to have a Republican Party at all? Yeah. agree on a set of standards. Let us agree on principles of fiscal responsibility, constitutional limits on the power of government, the defense of our individual freedoms, and then measure our candidates against those standards. What's wrong with being right? To those who think you must out-promise the opponents, don't underestimate the people. The vast majority of the Democratic rank and file would not knowingly support the liberal welfare philosophy if they could be shown the eventual price in lost freedom. And our job is to show them between now and next November. Remember, no matter how angry you get at them, we can't win by making them disappear. There's no way we can win without them. We have to do some converting. We have to talk on the street. We have to talk at our place of work. Now, you don't just try to sell it to them all at once and clobber them with it until they stiffen their backs and resent you or resist you. Feed them a little, and if they nibble a little, let it set and simmer for a while. Then go after them again. It's going to be a long, hard job, but don't think it's impossible. You never have seen a bigger bleeding heart liberal Democrat in your life than the one who's speaking to you now. I spent most of my adult life in that party. If I could be converted, believe me, it's possible for anyone. In the coming months, the Committee on Political Education is going to say to thousands of professional labor leaders all over this country, forget your regular chores for the next few months. You're on salary, but your job is to work for the election of Democratic candidates. You've got to match them. As volunteers, while still earning your living and working, you've got to match them phone call for phone call, front porch for front porch with your thumb on that bell button. And when the day of election comes, the people that you called in your precinct, you've got to call them again at 6 o'clock at night. And you'll find several that haven't gone to the polls. They were going. They got your other call. But then something happened, and now the kids are home from school, and there's no one to stay with them. And you've got to jump in your car and say, I'll be over and sit with the kids. Or I'll drive you down to make sure you vote. Because everyone on our side that doesn't vote is a half a vote for the other side. It is the only way elections are won. Once the $100 a plate dinners are over, the big television programs and the telethons and everything else. It's won or lost at the precinct level. It's won or lost on the front porch. We're going to get mad at each other until this primary is over, and we're probably going to stay mad. We can't afford it. I don't say that you've got to love every other one that you run into on our side, but at least from the end of the primary until next November, declare a moratorium on your dislike for someone who offended you in the pre-primary contest, and make up your mind that it isn't that you like them more, you dislike the Democrats more than you dislike the fellow you got mad at in your own party. No substitute for work. And no substitute for a united party. What's at stake? That should be your inspiration. Freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp in this nation than it is at this moment. All the things that I've discussed and mentioned are academic. If we do not come to a realization in this land and have a realization in high place in government that our nation is at war, and it's a war that must be won. That's the big issue of this election. Those who have spawned our present policy of accommodation, those who tell us that the enemy is moderating, that he's ready to join us in a search for peace, and that if we're only patient and we give in a little more and back away from a confrontation here and there, that he will grow to be more gentle, more democratic like us. Do those people really mean that they're in a search for peace? Or do they really mean they just want to be left in peace? Can we truly know peace in the world if we try to buy it at the price of slavery for a third of our fellow human beings in the world who are now enslaved by the Soviets. These people claim that we have a monopoly, that they have a monopoly on the solution to the Cold War and the bomb. Well, by what right do they claim that monopoly? What is their record? They were wrong about Alger Hiss. They were wrong about Harry Dexter White. They were wrong about Owen Lattimore. Wrong about Lachlan Curry. They were wrong about China. We look back today and realize that Hungary was the lost opportunity of a generation. They were wrong about the Congo and about Laos. They were wrong when they stopped MacArthur from crossing the Yalu River in Korea. They were wrong about Sukarno and wrong about the George Washington of Cuba. And now the most unforgivable, they have soiled our hands with murder in South Vietnam. We too want peace. But we know that peace can only be ours if we are willing to make a stand for those things which we know to be right. And take that stand before we are finally pushed back to the final point where we receive the ultimatum of fight or surrender. Because that's the inevitable result of appeasement, and whether they call it accommodation or whether they call it a process of moderation, this is the policy of the United States government today, appeasement. And it does not give us a choice between peace and war, only between fight or surrender. And if we permit them to continue this policy, when that final ultimatum comes, what will they say to us then? That it's better to be red than dead? And if this is true, if there is nothing in life worth dying for, where did it begin? Should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs rather than dare the wilderness? Should Christ have refused the cross? And should the patriots at Concord Bridge have refused to fire the shot heard round the world? You and I have an awesome responsibility. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny and a great challenge. And we'll meet that challenge and do what has to be done. Or you and I will live to see our children take the first step into 1,000 years of darkness. You and I have the opportunity to preserve this great experiment, the like of which has never been seen on earth. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us to the latest generation. We here hold the power and the responsibility. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of man on earth.